Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the most famous queens in all of history, Elizabeth. And no, not the one who recently passed away, but the previous Elizabeth of England, Queen Elizabeth I, the daughter of King Henry VIII, and a queen so important that the Renaissance in England is basically named after her. I previously did an episode over Henry VIII, so check that out for more information about him, but what may be surprising is that, despite being his daughter, Elizabeth was not his direct successor. No, in fact, there would be two rulers of England between the father and daughter. Okay, technically three. Granted, two of those rulers were Elizabeth's brother and sister. So we'll need to do some history diving there to figure out how we bridge the gap between two of the largest names in English history. And of course, you can't talk about Elizabeth's reign without talking about the Renaissance. Obviously, Shakespeare never ruled over any countries, so this is probably going to be my only chance to talk about the bard during this show. But the English Renaissance was an important era overall for Elizabeth's nation, and it was more than just Shakespeare's plays. The Elizabethan era is ripe with all sorts of developments in both the arts, sciences, and beyond. Elizabeth I has a bit of everything going on in her life, meaning I better get into the episode. So without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to England at the height of the Renaissance in the 16th century in The Age of Elizabeth, Part 1, The Trouble with Tudors. In the background history lesson, let's once again talk about the Renaissance. I've talked about the Renaissance as a whole before, but mostly in the context of the period in Italy. So let's get on with the briefest of general overviews. The word Renaissance itself comes from the Italian word for rebirth. It was a period of time following the Middle Ages, usually dating from sometime in the 14th century to the 17th century. At the tail end of the Middle Ages, people in Europe really started getting back into studying classical art and philosophy from ancient Greece and Rome. Sometimes this was knowledge that was literally lost and uncovered later. Other times, it was finding out that the libraries in predominantly Muslim nations still had copies of books that were thought to be gone when Rome collapsed. And though the Renaissance began in Italy, the invention of the printing press in circa 1440 helped spread ideas across Europe at a much faster rate than ever before. And it's really the printing press that would help lead the way for England to join the Renaissance alongside Italy. Granted, referring to this era in England as the Renaissance might be a bit of a misnomer. Like I said, the Renaissance was a rebirth of study and love for all things Greek and Roman. This made sense in Italy. But in England, they weren't really going all in on stuff from those regions. England's existence during the Renaissance was just becoming much more English. Like with Dante's Divine Comedy technically being something akin to a Renaissance work despite technically predating the Renaissance in Italy, you had late medieval works like Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales paving the way in England for the age that would eventually come to pass. In fact, the printing press helped change the English language as a whole. Before the printing press, people in England were still more or less talking in what we call Middle English, which is what you'd find in Canterbury Tales. It's more recognizable as English compared to the completely Germanic Old English, but it still takes a minute sometimes to read relatively simple sentences. With the printing press, specifically in England under the use of merchant/writer William Caxton, a more unified dialect was spread throughout the nation, bringing English up to a more modern variation. And just as a fun side note, the first printed best-selling book in England was Thomas Malory's La Morte d'Arthur, one of the most famous collections of stories about King Arthur, and the one I use for all of my episodes I've done over him. The printing press's heyday in England also happened to coincide with the rise of the Protestant Reformation. The Reformation sought to upend the power of the Pope when it came to Christianity in Western Europe. One of the important aspects of the Reformation, as far as we're concerned for this background, is that the religious movement relied on people being able to interpret the Bible as they saw fit, not necessarily how the Vatican interpreted the Holy Book. The Bible was one of the most widely printed books during the Renaissance. In England, the Bible was also being printed in English, meaning that the common folk of the nation could now actually read what was being written rather than listen to a priest talking at them in Latin, which most of the audience probably didn't actually understand anyways. England had, at least for a while, kind of been at odds with the Vatican as it was. Unlike the other European nations who still practiced Catholicism, who had their local bishops elected by the Pope, England's bishops were elected by the king. This caused some tension between England and Rome, but it was never really a huge problem until King Henry VIII. If you haven't listened to that episode, basically, Henry wanted to divorce his first wife to marry his mistress. Unfortunately, divorce is a no-go in Catholicism. Using his power as the king, Henry gathered up a group of loyal religious figures in England and decided to separate the Catholic Church in England from the rest of the world, forming the Church of England with the king as the head of the religion. From there, Henry was free to divorce as much as he wanted, mostly with the sole aim of having a son. His first two marriages would result in daughters, Mary and Elizabeth. It was on his third, though not last, marriage that Henry would finally get his wish when his wife, Jane Seymour, gave birth to his son, Edward. Immediately, young Edward became Henry's heir. Unfortunately for both Edward and the nation of England, Henry VIII died when his son was only 9 years old. Young Edward, now Edward VI, was crowned in February of 1547. As part of Henry VIII's will, while Edward was King of England, the actual goings-on of the nation would come under the command of a small body of noblemen that would act as a council for the king until he was an adult and could rule in his own right. While this seemed like a decent enough idea, it left a gateway open for anyone conniving enough to consider themselves worthy of ruling the kingdom. The conniving politician in question was Edward's uncle, Edward Seymour. Seymour, as a living blood relative of the king, was given plenty of titles, including Lord Protector of the Realm. He used his new honors to bring King Edward under his control. Despite protests from Edward's Council of Nobles, Seymour more or less held all the power in England for a couple years before the council had had enough, especially after Seymour more or less kidnapped his nephew and kept him under house arrest in Windsor Castle. In late October of 1549, Seymour was arrested and deposed from his position as Lord Protector. The rest of Edward's reign would see England more or less come under the control of John Dudley, the Earl of Warwick. Dudley stepped in as head of the council after Seymour's arrest. Because he was not a blood relative of King Edward, Dudley tried his best to fill the government with his family members and other nobles who were loyal to him. However, Dudley, unlike Seymour, did kind of realize the fact that Edward was the actual king. And there seems to be some evidence that Edward was starting to get into the role of king, even if he was still not yet a teenager. He was allowed to elect members of certain councils and even sat in on important political hearings. The biggest drama during Edward's reign was in 1550 when he was betrothed to Elizabeth of House Valois, Princess of France. Now, Edward was only 13 and Elizabeth was 5, so it would be a while until they would actually be married. However, the bigger issue here, at least for the sake of the narrative, is that France was Catholic but England was Protestant. When the Pope found out about this, he threatened to excommunicate both Edward and Elizabeth, which is weird that he felt he had any authority over Edward. Anyways, the marriage was all set up to go through until Edward died in 1553. Because he was only 15 and obviously did not have any children, this created a problem for the line of succession. Or at least it would have if Edward hadn't come up with a plan when his health started failing. Because he was a medieval king in a Protestant nation, Edward knew that neither of his half-sisters could take over, because they were both women and Mary, the oldest, was Catholic. Instead, he decreed that his cousin Jane Grey should take over. Ignore the fact that she's a woman for this to make sense. The council held off on proclaiming Edward's death to the public because they wanted to secure the throne for Jane, knowing that Edward's sisters would riot over his will. And if Mary was on the throne as a Catholic, she would set back the Church of England's independent status. Well, Mary quickly found out and raced off to make herself queen. Unfortunately, on the 10th of July, the council crowned Jane Grey as Queen of England to a very middling response. Meanwhile, Mary had managed to gather a massive following. While the remaining Catholics of England flocked to her side, so too did many other citizens who saw her as the rightful leader of the nation as the eldest child of King Henry VIII. After only 9 days, and as Mary gathered a legitimate army, the council decided to end Jane Grey's reign and named Mary as the new Queen of England. Mary's reign basically went over exactly how everyone assumed it would go. She quickly got to work trying to reverse England's path down the road of Protestantism. She released Catholics who had been imprisoned and even put a few on the council. The only reason she never fully succeeded in her plans was due to Parliament existing and the institution very much not wanting Mary to have her way. Mary was also very keen on not having her younger half-sister be her successor, again because Elizabeth was a Protestant like the rest of her family. In order to see this through, Mary decided to get married to a prince of Spain named Felipe. As with many of Mary's policies, this decision was met with mass criticism, even from her supporters in the government. Her critics obviously hated that Felipe was Catholic. Her supporters wished Mary would have chosen an English suitor for her husband. There was also the fact that, even though Mary was queen in her own right, there were still laws about property ownership for women, namely that any property of a woman belonged to her husband. This law still technically applied to the queen. The English feared that if a Spanish prince was her husband, then he would technically become the King of England. And though Felipe would be called King of England during the couple's marriage, it was still very apparent to everyone that Mary was the actual ruler of the nation. Any children they had would succeed her. Unfortunately for Mary, like Edward, she passed away without giving birth to any children. She had kind of realized this would be the case for a while. So, regrettably passing away in November of 1558, Mary's death paved the way for Elizabeth to take the throne as the new Queen of England. Elizabeth was born in 1533 as the second child of Henry VIII and the first child born after his marriage to Anne Boleyn, his second wife. Due to the annulment of Henry's marriage to Catherine of Aragon, this meant that, at the time of her birth, Elizabeth was the heir apparent to the throne of England. Obviously, that wouldn't last for too long. Before her third birthday, Elizabeth's mother was beheaded after false charges of adultery were thrown her way. With Anne Boleyn's death and the annulment of her marriage to the king, Elizabeth's place in the line of succession was thrown out. As a young child, Elizabeth was shown to be extremely intelligent when it came to learning new languages. Before she was 13 years old, she had been taught French, Spanish, Italian, Latin, and Greek. Throughout much of the rest of her life, Elizabeth, in her free time, would translate classical works from ancient Greece and Rome into English. Even later in her life, Elizabeth would continue to learn new languages, apparently becoming mostly fluent in almost every language spoken on the British Isles, meaning she added Scottish Gaelic, Welsh, Cornish, and Irish to her repertoire. Granted, I did an episode over Grainne O'Malley, a minor queen from Ireland who met Queen Elizabeth. Apparently, Elizabeth couldn't speak enough Irish to converse with Grainne, so they had to speak Latin with each other, so I'm a bit wary over how much Irish Elizabeth actually knew. Also, obviously, she was raised as a Protestant because she was the daughter of King Henry VIII. When she was 13 years old, Elizabeth's father passed away, and you know how things went politically from there. Elizabeth was taken into the home of Catherine Parr, Henry's last wife. She was married to Thomas Seymour, King Edward's uncle and younger brother of the Edward Seymour who tried to monopolize control over the king. As it turned out, the younger brother was just as bad as the Lord Protector, but in a different, just weirder way. So here's the thing. I can't say that Thomas Seymour actually sexually assaulted Elizabeth, but it's still just a lot of weird things that do make him sound like a pedophile. He would enter her bedroom in the morning, tickle Elizabeth, and then spank her. And Catherine didn't do anything to help. No, apparently she also joined in on the weird behavior a couple times. Apparently, Catherine's balking point was when she found Edward hugging Elizabeth in the younger woman's room. After about a year and a half of living with Catherine and Thomas, Elizabeth was sent away to live with another relative in May of 1548. After Catherine's death, which was only a few months later in September of that year, Thomas began pursuing Elizabeth, asking her to marry him. Elizabeth was having absolutely none of that, even when her governess attempted to persuade her otherwise. Luckily, Thomas was arrested in 1549 as part of the arrest involving his brother and was beheaded. When her half-brother died and Queen Mary was crowned, Elizabeth initially decided to support her half-sister's reign. After all, the pair had been sidelined multiple times by the men of the royal family. However, it became immediately apparent that the two would never see eye to eye due to the difference in their religious upbringings. Things became increasingly strained when an uprising in early 1554 sought to kick Mary out of power and replace her with Elizabeth. Wyatt's Rebellion, named after one of the leaders of the attempted coup, was very unsuccessful. And it should be noted that Elizabeth had absolutely nothing to do with the uprising. However, Mary did not believe that. In March of that year, she had Elizabeth imprisoned in the Tower of London and questioned. Though some of Mary's advisors made it abundantly clear that they wanted Elizabeth dead, the latter's supporters in the government managed to win out, citing that there was no clear evidence that Elizabeth was actually involved with the rebellion. In May, Elizabeth was released from the Tower of London and placed under house arrest. After a year, she was allowed to return to the royal court. And as I said before, Mary would end up passing away in 1558 without having sired an heir. Even in the months beforehand, King Felipe, Mary's husband, approached Elizabeth with the full knowledge that she would be the next queen and sought to start diplomatic negotiations. Felipe fully supported Elizabeth due to the fear that the crown would potentially go to Queen Mary of Scotland, Elizabeth's cousin who was married to the heir apparent of France. In January of 1559, at the age of 25, Elizabeth was crowned as the new Queen of England to fervent praise by the citizens of her nation. And with her coronation, England would enter into a new era of its Renaissance evolution. First and foremost, Elizabeth wanted to solidify the power of the Church of England in the wake of her sister's death. Under her father, the Church of England was more or less just Catholicism, but without the power of Rome. Under Edward, things really started to become Protestant. Aspects that were traditionally Catholic within the Anglican Church started to be shaved off. Communion was no longer literally considered the body and blood of Jesus. Purgatory was no longer a thing, the power of the saints was greatly diminished. Everything started moving much closer to the way of the Protestant Reformation. Then, obviously, Mary stepped in and reversed all that. Elizabeth's goal was to find some sort of ground that proved England was very much a Protestant nation, but without fully alienating the Catholics she governed. That being said, it was kind of clear that Elizabeth didn't really want Catholics having any sort of power. Elizabeth was never open about her religious views, but it was also very apparent that she was extremely Protestant. However, she also was not Protestant enough to be considered a Puritan, which was a rather extreme group of Protestants in England who would soon leave the nation and eventually live in the colonial United States, where they did such fun things as the Salem Witch Trials. Elizabeth also did not like the Puritans, though. In 1559, Parliament passed two different acts that would pave the way for the new Church of England under Elizabeth. Oddly, both of these laws are referred to with the year 1558, despite being passed the next year. In the Act of Supremacy, Elizabeth was proclaimed the supreme governor of the Church of England, and all clergy members within England and the lands it governed had to acknowledge Elizabeth under that title or be accused of treason. Originally, the new title for Elizabeth was supposed to be the supreme head of the Church of England, but too many people voted against the name, insisting that the head of the church, one, should not be a woman, and two, already existed and his name was Jesus. The Act of Uniformity created the new system of the church. It addressed prayers that were to be said, how priests should dress, and created a fine for not attending church services on Sunday. Overall, the implementation of these laws was messy at best. There were still many Catholics in England who were unwilling to go along with the changes. Also, the heads of the Church of England selected to oversee the changes were not necessarily all that great at making sure all the individual parishes in England conformed to the new laws. It ended up taking a couple more decades under Elizabeth's rule before the Church of England finally became something closer to a unified force. The religious reforms would ultimately culminate in Queen Elizabeth being formally excommunicated by the Catholic Church in February of 1570 after the remaining Catholics in England complained to the Pope. But then again, Elizabeth didn't consider herself Catholic or under the control of the papacy anyway, so things just kept going the course. The Protestants had won the religious war in England, at least for the time being. There would be continued arguments from every angle throughout the rest of Elizabeth's reign, but to this day, England technically remains a Protestant nation with the monarch as the head of its church. One of the biggest questions that was presented right off the bat once Elizabeth took over was who she was going to marry. After all, it was a monarch's duty to marry, sire an heir, and continue the royal bloodline. From the very beginning, it seemed as if Elizabeth was planning on marrying a man named Robert Dudley, who happened to be the son of John Dudley, the man who oversaw Edward's rule after Edward Seymour was arrested. The younger Dudley and Elizabeth had been close since they were young, and it seemed like a foregone conclusion to many nobles that the pair would eventually get married. There was just one tiny speed bump in the road to that happening. Dudley was already married by the time Elizabeth became queen. Dudley was an interesting guy. Like I said, his father effectively ruled England until King Edward's death. Robert's younger brother was married to Lady Jane Grey, so he fought against the army raised by Mary Tudor when she rebelled against the short-lived reign. For a few months, both Robert and Elizabeth would have been imprisoned in the Tower of London at the exact same time. His father and younger brother were executed for treason, but Dudley's mother managed to make an inroad with Queen Mary's husband. From there, he kinda got favor with the royal court, but he was only allowed to be in the court if King Felipe was also there. Despite the fact that Dudley had gotten married in 1550, so during Edward's reign, Felipe started considering pairing him and Elizabeth together in order to secure a position of friendship and influence in Elizabeth's court. This obviously happening when it was obvious that his wife was going to pass away sooner or later. Robert's wife, Amy, was sick for a while, in what seems all signs to point to breast cancer. Apparently, Elizabeth had confided with some members of the court that she would be perfectly fine marrying Robert if Amy passed away. When Elizabeth became queen, Dudley was chosen as her master of the horse, which was a very high-ranking position of the court back in those days. Everyone seemed to think it was only a matter of time before the pair were married. Still, despite the fact that Dudley was married and his wife was very much alive. Well, in 1560, Lady Amy passed away. The official story is that she fell down a flight of stairs, which means all kinds of rumors persisted about her death. Most obvious among the rumors is that Robert killed her. There are other rumors that she threw herself down the stairs to commit suicide, whether it was due to being unable to live with her illness or the fact that her husband was in love with the queen. Well, weirdly enough, with Robert now newly single, the pair just kinda never got together. It seems like some of the more conservative members of Elizabeth's council were very vocal about not wanting Dudley, a man who had helped Jane Grey and was a friend of Felipe, holding power in England. So, Elizabeth decided against courting him. Even then, it's said that she still held some sort of romantic feelings for him. Dudley would pass away in 1588 before Elizabeth. His final letter to her was considered one of her personal treasures. And despite other suitors looking to gain her affection, Elizabeth chose to never marry. In fact, it was widely spread that Elizabeth remained a virgin her entire life, which I certainly have doubts about. The cult surrounding the idea of Elizabeth's virginity was just a really strange historical case. In fact, the state of Virginia in the US is named after Elizabeth. Yeah, the fact that she was a virgin. Anyways, this is a weird topic, so let's move along to something a bit more fun. Even though he's not really related to Elizabeth at all, I want to talk about Shakespeare. I mean, theater in Elizabethan England was a big deal. Such a big deal that plays from this time are still some of the most popular stories all over the world. And in order to talk about Shakespeare, let's first talk about theater as a whole in London at this point in time. Permanent theaters weren't really a thing when Elizabeth became queen. Religious passion plays were performed around Easter telling the story of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, and some holidays found amateur theater groups performing out in the streets. Unfortunately, Elizabeth's reign also saw several resurgences of the bubonic plague, and the mayor and city council of London wanted to tackle that problem. So, in 1572, it became illegal to put on plays in public. 3 years later, actors were not even allowed within the city. To overcome this, a permanent theater called, and I kid you not, The Theater, was constructed in 1576 in the Shoreditch region, which in modern times is within the city limits of London. The theater proved to be very successful, and other permanent theaters began popping up over the next couple decades. Also during this time, classical Greek and Roman plays were brought over from continental Europe and performed for the masses. Plays during the Elizabethan era were a rare event when both the common citizens and the nobility were able to see the same performance at the same time. And theater proved to be very popular, as admissions suffered from heavy inflation that could see show tickets sextuple in price. And in all of this fervor, we get Shakespeare. Born in 1564 to a decently well-off family, his father was a politician and his mother's family was Anglo-Saxon landed gentry since at least 1066, William Shakespeare's early life is relatively unknown. Even his birthday is unknown, and people eventually just decided he was born on the 23rd of April, since that's the day he died and people like symmetry. In grammar school, he would have learned about grammar, and studied classical Latin texts. After getting married at the age of 18, Will disappeared until 1592 when he's called out by fellow playwright Robert Greene as a man attempting to reach above his abilities. This has led us to think Shakespeare was in the theater scene for at least a few years before then. By 1594, Shakespeare's plays were being exclusively performed by the Lord Chamberlain's Men Acting Troupe, a group sponsored by the head of the royal households, basically the most senior overseer of the various departments of the English government who also facilitated communication between the Queen and Parliament. This was obviously a massive honor for our bard. The original group played at the theater, but several years later played exclusively at the famous Globe Theater. By 1598, Shakespeare had garnered enough popularity that his name became a selling point for his plays. He would also act in those plays, usually in the role of a king that was not the main character, so never a Macbeth or King Richard III type. Shakespeare's earliest works are thought to have been some of his historical plays, detailing the history of English kings, King Richard III and King Henry VI are thought to perhaps be his first two. He was writing in an era where plays about the history of England were very much in demand, and it's thought that maybe Shakespeare's plays act as a bit of propaganda to show the right to rule of House Tudor. He was also writing comedies in these early days, giving way to his more famous tragedies like Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth towards the end of the 16th century and early 17th century. Many of Shakespeare's plays were either adaptations of historical books or heavily influenced by his fellow playwrights of the time, but he was obviously able to write his own masterpieces from his own creative fount of imagination. There's been people who say that Shakespeare didn't actually write all of his plays, we say he did, but those people are wrong. Like I said, Shakespeare took a lot of inspiration from the popular histories and plays of his time. Just because some of his works might have sounded like those of fellow Elizabethan writer Christopher Marlowe doesn't mean Marlowe wrote those. And also, you can't talk about Shakespeare without talking about how he made up many words we still use today. There are also some words that only became popular because he used them in his plays. Some of these words include apostrophe, bloody, critic and critical, dishearten, dwindle, downstairs, eyeball, generous, gloomy, gnarled, hurry, jaded, invulnerable, lonely, majestic, obscene, puppy dog, rant, suspicious, and varied. So even if you didn't like reading his plays in school, you at least gotta give it up to the Bard of Stratford-upon-Avon for his wordplay. Also, hey, if you do find reading Shakespeare in school boring, just talk to your teacher and tell them, hey, we should either be performing these plays or seeing a performance, because reading a play is not the same as actually seeing it performed. Though there were other facets of the Elizabethan era that were important for the advancements of science and law, you have to give it up for the theater scene as well. And I'm sure many people wouldn't care about this era of theater as much, including its wild history, if it wasn't for William Shakespeare. Alright, now that I got to talk about Shakespeare for maybe a bit too long, let's get back to Elizabeth. Despite seeming like things were all great and full of reforms that shaped England into a much more cohesive and modern version of itself, Elizabeth's reign was filled with many different complications that sought to overturn both her position as queen and England's position of power within the greater European world. As always, there was the nation of France right across the channel that had been a thorn in the side of England ever since the Normans crossed in 1066, and even before then if we're being honest. When she was crowned, even though she had the backing of her subjects and Spain as a bonus thanks to her half-brother-in-law, is that what Felipe would be technically called? Elizabeth knew that France would look for a way to dig their claws into England once more. And unfortunately for the Queen, she knew just the strategy France would seek in order to push her aside. Mary. No, not her half-sister. How would France use a dead woman? No, I'm talking about Mary, Queen of Scotland. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. As I'm sure you can imagine, next episode we'll be finishing up Elizabeth's reign by talking about the many hurdles she faced while paving the way for England's future. And of course, the plot involving Mary, Queen of Scots, will be a major point when we get there. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.